welcome to The Happy Writer. This is a podcast that aims to bring readers more books to enjoy and to help authors find more joy in their writing. I am your host, Marissa Meyer. Thanks for joining me. As a reminder, we are still looking for our first official podcast sponsors. If you are interested in advertising here on The Happy Writer, please let us know. You can find contact information at marissameyer.com/podcast. One thing making me happy this week. This is Halloween. This is Halloween. 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 You don't get to hear me sing on every episode. Did you know this is the 30-year anniversary of one of the best movies of all time, Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas? I have probably mentioned in years past that we do have an annual family tradition of watching the movie with the girls this time every year, but here we are 4 months living in our new house, and we actually still don't have our TV hooked up. So I realized this a few days ago, and I had a panic moment. How are we going to watch The Nightmare Before Christmas? But then I looked it up and was thrilled to learn that as part of the 30th anniversary, it's actually going to be in theaters this year. And I literally squealed and was like, girls, I have the best news ever. So we're going to go watch the movie in theaters this year, and I am so looking forward to it. Perfect solution. Everybody wins. I am also, of course, so happy to be talking to today's guest. They are a director, writer, and storyboard artist living in Los Angeles, and they have worked on the TV series The Owl House, Star vs. the Forces of Evil, and Gravity Falls. They're also the creator of the popular webcomic, The Glass Scientist, which is now being published as a graphic novel series. Volume 1 just came out earlier this month. Please welcome S.H. Coutinho.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you. How did I do on your name pronunciation?
That was great. Thank you so much. Okay? That's perfect. It's a tough one.
No, it's so lovely to have you. Thank you for joining me and congratulations. I know you've been creating the webcomic for quite a while, but this is your first physical publication. How's it going?
Yeah, it's my debut year. Oh my gosh, it's been so much. I've been, we had a really nice launch event a couple weeks ago, which was really lovely, at this wonderful little bookstore in Los Angeles called Once Upon a Time Books.
Wait,
are you in the area?
Oh no, but I've been there on book tour.
Oh, that's awesome. But yeah, I've also been running this pre-order campaign because, as you mentioned, you know, this was a webcomic for 8 years previously. So it's been around for a bit, and I have, you know, a pretty decent pre-existing readership. And so to kind of incentivize people to, you know, who were previously, you know, reading the comic for free to come out and buy it, I wanted to give them a little something extra to incentivize it. So I am shipping out about 1,500 little pre-order packages in a few weeks. So it's been a lot.
Oh my gosh, that is so much mailing.
It is so much mailing. Yeah.
What was the gift?
So I did a couple of things, you know, again, because I have like the art background, so I can kind of produce whatever I want for it. So I did like, you know, a little bookmark, a little sticker, a little, my favorite thing was like I did a little enamel pin.
Cool.
Which I've never done before. So I had to learn that process. I really enjoy making like physical objects. It's kind of a nice, to me, it's like a nice little anti-anxiety thing where that if you can get so wrapped up in, you know, the minutiae of word choice or, you know, color choice, there's so many little things you can get obsessed with. And to focus your attention instead on just like a physical, you know, like, oh, there's like, this thing is made of metal and there's only so many things you can do with a physical bit of metal. I find that to be a very pleasant just contrast with my daily anxieties.
Oh, how interesting. No, that makes sense too. And it's a very, it's still a creative outlet, but like, uses different parts of your brain for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I used to do needle felting. Have you ever heard of that?
I have. Yeah.
Yeah. I had this professor in school who I did not always agree with. So I would literally, I would bring needle felting to class while he was doing the very long, it was like 3 hour long classes. And I would just kind of like poke at my little needle felting thing just to kind of get some rage out. It's fun. It's nice to have something to do with your hands.
That's funny. Needle felting, voodoo dolls, you know. Awesome. So the first thing that I like to ask all of my guests, I'd love to hear your origin story. Did you always know you wanted to be a writer, an artist? How did you get here?
Oh my gosh. You know, I think I definitely always wanted to tell my own stories. I think probably some of my earliest memories is that my mom is not a creative writer by any means. She's very, you know, a smart person. She's a judge now, incidentally. But she would just transcribe little stories that I would kind of dictate to her as a little kid, which were these really bizarre, like, space opera, psychosexual adventures. So I've always been drawn to like very, very strange fantastical stories. But I think when I was probably like in fifth grade, my best friend was like, I'm going to enter this novel writing contest and I'm going to be a novelist. And I was like, no, I'm going to be a novelist. And she kind of got bored with it after about, I don't know, a few months or so. But I just kind of never stopped, you know? But my kind of turn to visual storytelling kind of happened around like, I don't know, seventh or eighth grade. And, you know, I'd grown up, you know, watching the, you know, the Disney Renaissance films, your Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, et cetera. And I think at that age, I kind of stumbled back into them and was kind of the first time when I looked at them and recognized like, oh, these aren't just like cute kids' film. There's like a huge amount of artistry and skill that goes into that. And so I got very interested in that type of storytelling and that type of art, which is more about, you know, character and emotion and, you know, bringing life to still images. Yeah. And so that was kind of my pivot into that. From there, you know, I think I was always very aware of how precarious a creative life can be. So I was very hesitant to be like, you know, I'm going to be a novelist 100%. Mm-hmm. But by comparison, you know, animation is an industry, you know, and I feel like I had a clearer in to like, okay, that is a job you can do. It's a tough job to get into, but if you can, you know, it is a decent, you know, living you can make. It is unionized, which I think is, I'm very, very happy for, and very, very happy that, you know, for the result of the writer's strike that happened recently, I hope we can get something similar next year. And so I pursued that in college. But the entire time I kind of like secretly holding this flame of like, I would still like to make a book though, you know?
Someday.
Yeah. Yeah. It was always in the back of my mind. And I think after I graduated college, I was able to get into animation. I started, my first full-time job was on the show Gravity Falls, which is a really fantastic show. Around that time, it kind of sunk in that like, oh, the thing about animation, it is a massive collaborative medium and industry where the people who get to tell their own stories are, there's very, very, very few people who actually get that opportunity. Realistically, most people are working on other people's stories. And I was like, oh, if I want to tell my own story, I've got to kind of do something else. And the specific profession I was in within animation is called storyboarding, which is basically you take a script and you kind of draw out every single moment down to the character beat, down to, you know, expression changes, everything. It's very similar to comics. And so I was like, well, why don't I try out comics? And, you know, I just kind of launched it one day and never stopped. And that's kind of how I got to where I am now.
I love that. Were you a reader and lover of comics?
Yeah, I think I was very specifically into like a very particular niche of like indie comics. I was really online during like your LiveJournal days back in the early 2000s.
Oh, that's a blast from the past.
Yeah, yeah. And like there was this one group, I don't know how I found them, of like indie artists, which included like Jen Wang and Erica Moen and some other folks who had a little collective that they would post on this one LiveJournal group, and I'd absolutely like worshipped them. So I was never into like your Marvel, DC. I'm still not a big superhero person, honestly. But I was really into these more slice of life or fantasy, but in a less, you know, action adventure kind of way, that are more, you know, emotions focused, that are a little bit more grounded. And that's still what I'm drawn to the most.
Yeah. Well, I love graphic novels, and I like, you know, let's point out that not every comic and graphic novel has to be Superman or Batman.
Of course.
Like, it's such a wide variety in this genre. But I also think it's interesting that you started way, way, way back when thinking you wanted to write novels. So I have to ask, do you think that a novel might be in your future?
I would love that. Yeah. I mean, I think I was actually just talking with Nate Stevenson, who wrote Nimona, you know, which is the basis of the film that came out this year. And he is writing a prose novel. And I was just like absolutely fascinated by it. I'm like, how is that happening? How can you write words without pictures? So it's something I'm super interested in. You know, as much as I love comics, I'm so happy for the experience I've had on The Glass Scientist. you know, it's a lot of work. Like, yeah. No matter which way you slice it, I think the amount of time you have to spend on the art is going to be about 10 times longer than the writing, just because it is such an affair to create. And so I would love people to just kind of focus in a little bit more on storytelling, so I don't have to spend 10 years making the next one. That'd be great.
Yeah. No, that's fair.
There is something very magical about, you know, being able to write like, and then they walked out onto a busy city street, and there were thousands of people all in different costumes, and there were elephants and magic and fire. And you can just write that in a single sentence, where I was like, that is like a month of work, you know?
No, that's so true. I love writing graphic novels. I've got one that's coming out, I think, what is it? Currently scheduled for like spring of 25, but I only do the script. I'm not the illustrator. And so for me, it's like this great, I can write the story, write the dialogue, kind of come up with who the characters are personality wise, but all of those little details, I'm like, well, that's the illustrator's problem.
Like, well, don't make too big of a problem.
It's like, you figure it out. It's totally different from writing a novel where I'd have to like, oh, now I actually have to describe what we're seeing, where we are, what the smells are, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it's fun. I love writing graphic novels, but I'm also kind of grateful that I don't have to illustrate them.
I mean, it can be really nice, even like if I would be open to work doing another graphic novel with someone else as the artist. I'm in a writer's group with Molly Ostertag, who recently did a graphic novel series kind of based in the D&D space. And she brought in one of my favorite illustrators. So I was extremely jealous that she got to work with this person. But like seeing someone else bring their unique art and their unique vision to a space, something that you couldn't do even as an artist yourself, is really cool. That's been something I've really enjoyed, you know, developing animated shows as well. You know, a couple of years ago, I did a show that was kaiju based, like, you know, Godzilla, etc. And I had to go up to my executive and be like, yo, I can draw characters. I can't draw monsters at all. You got to bring someone else to do that. And so they brought in some people to help me out with, and they did a fantastic job. And it was like really cool to be like, you guys are so much better than this. Please go nuts, you know?
Yeah. No, and it's nice that when you're collaborating, you don't have to come up with everything all by yourself. And it can be really inspirational, too, to see, you know, someone else take this idea and take it in a totally different direction than your brain would have taken it.
Yeah. Like, it's such a different skill, that collaborative, creative aspect. Because I think like there can be on the one hand, you know, a tendency to write, you know, the kind of, you know, like, and then a giant battle happened with 1,000 horses and it's going to last 5 chapters. Go draw it. You know, like that's not great. But there's also kind of like the micromanaging space I can get into, which I think I land a little bit closer at times. So I feel like I'm still very much learning like how to leave space for other people's creativity. But I feel like when it works, it's really, really magical. And also adds like a nice social element. So it doesn't feel as isolating as writing sometimes can.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that writers in general have a little bit of that micromanaging aspect to us. I think that's fairly universal, which is maybe why we are drawn to creating stories and worlds in which we are in control of literally every detail and aspect of them. All right, so here you are. Your debut graphic novel has just come out. Not a collaborative project. It is all you. At least I'm assuming. I guess I could be wrong about that. Would you please tell listeners, what is The Glass Scientist about?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, I quickly want to shout out that I work with a couple assistants over the years who help me with, you know, some color work or background inking right now. So I just want to call out that I've worked with assistants Tina Purin, Julia Elliott and Lucy Shu. Anyway, sorry, I heard that. Just want to get that out of the way.
I wasn't
overlooking anybody. But okay, yes, quick elevator pitch of The Glass Scientist. The Glass Scientist is a YA graphic novel series. It's going to be a 3-series book, reimagining characters from classic gothic science fiction, such as, you know, Dr. Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll, and Mr. Hyde. And it specifically follows a young Dr. Henry Jekyll as he tries to create a safe haven for mad scientists in a treacherous alternate Victorian London filled with bubbling potions and misunderstood monsters.
I love it. So, of course, inspired by the classic Jekyll and Hyde. So I had the book sitting out on my coffee table And I hadn't started reading it yet. And my kids, I've got 8-year-old twins, and they saw it and they were like, "Ooh, what is this about?" Because the cover is so cool. And I was like, "Well, I don't know because I haven't read it yet, but I can tell you what Jekyll and Hyde is about." And so I was kind of giving them the elevator pitch for Jekyll and Hyde. Mm-hmm. And they were like, "That sounds amazing."
That's delightful.
It's a great story. First of all, for you, why Jekyll and Hyde? What was it that drew you to retelling or being inspired by this particular work of fiction?
Yeah, you know, like I loved that story pretty much since I was a very little kid. When I was super little, I watched this film called The Pagemaster, which was this kind of like hybrid animated film from like the early 90s, which was a little going on a little journey through classic literature. And one of them was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And it was just so like dramatic and fun and spooky that it really made a really big impression on me. But I think what really drew me to that story in particular is that I've always been drawn to kind of dual identity stories. I am a dual identity person. I am mixed race. I am non-binary and also queer. And I've always fallen in between kind of clear categories of things, you know? You know, I think, for instance, you know, the bisexual experience is kind of messy space where you're neither in the straight world or the gay world. And I think there's been a lot more discussion and discourse about that as a particular identity nowadays. But growing up, it was, you know, not really talked about or was fetishized. And like there were all these kind of unpleasant aspects to being in that in-between space. And I think this story kind of like tapped into all of those feelings and the desire to be like, oh, I wish I just was one thing or another. And so like, I totally get why this dude is that like, oh, I don't fit. I'm just going to take a potion that's going to split me in two and then I'll fit in. You know, I found that very relatable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about, like for me, and I'll admit it's been a long time since I read Jekyll and Hyde. I mean, I think it was like in high school maybe. And like, I love exploring characters that have those gray areas, you mm-hmm. know, there are they yeah. evil? Are they good? So many are like, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, it's like the epitome of that, of exploring mm-hmm. good and bad in one character. It would be so fun.
Yeah. And I think what's special about that story is that the original story, it's a very simple novella. The plot is very, very simple. There's not a ton of characters and a lot of it is kind of left in this kind of vague space. I think a lot of people are surprised when they go back to like the old timey science fiction that, you know, there is no scene in, say, Frankenstein where they go into the lab and he's got his lab coat on and, you know, here's exactly how I did this. They often are kind of vague as to like the scientific processes behind it. And it's all very allegorical. Mm-hmm. And where that leaves a lot of interesting room in Jekyll and Hyde is that it really leaves space for this question of, you know, how are we defining good and evil here? Like, how do we define this? And I think, especially in the context of, you know, this is a Victorian story where everything was very categorized, you know, men did this and women did that and civilized people did this and savage people did that, that it really kind of muddies the boundaries. Because I mean, the shock of the original story, why it's a little bit hard for, I think, modern readers to go back to is that the entire premise of the original story is that the reader doesn't know that Dr. Jekyll is Mr. Hyde. So if you already know it ahead of time, it's a little bit of a bummer.
That's a good point. the twist gets lost a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel like we kind of need adaptations of this story to kind of bring a new audience into it. Cause like, I love the original story. It's not a modern day crowd pleaser, I would say, but if you look at the original premise, what it's trying to do is it really is trying to take the audience's assumptions of what an upper class, you know, well-to-do doctor should be and what a, you know, a lower class, vaguely criminal, untrustworthy person should be. And then it's like, oh, hey, I'm going to turn that on your head, you know? So that's the whole premise is that, you know, these strict categories that we want to place people in don't really exist.
Yeah. And I love that you did set it in the same time period as opposed to like doing a modern setting, a contemporary story based here. Did you play around with that? Were you like, no, I really want to be in this world that has these kind of narrow ideas of, you know, what is civilized, what is proper. Because I feel like that would add some complications, but also kind of some avenues for exploring different things in these characters.
Yeah, I mean, I was always pretty adamant that it should take place in the original time period. And there's a couple things that I love about the Victorian era. One is like the aesthetic is just peak, in my opinion.
Oh, so great.
Give me some neo-Gothic and I'm just happy. I'm very happy with a lot of like big pointy arches, number one. But two, I feel like I've always kind of resonated with this time period that, again, was so restrictive, almost to a almost kind of cartoonish level in a certain way. Because I think, and maybe this is an aspect of neurodivergence in me, I think I find myself often kind of running up against the unspoken rules that still exist in our modern world, you know? Mm. And I think to me, there's a weird comfort in like taking gender expectations or, you know, expectations for class or, you know, morality, the things that are very, that still exist, that we're still grappling with, but which people kind of try and act like don't exist or will take as an assumption. And then it's like, nope, we're going to bring it out in the open and discuss it very, very literally and very directly. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely not, it's not intended to be like a picture perfect, historically accurate depiction of the Victorian era. It's very much using that as a lens for the modern world.
Yeah, no, I love that. So talk to me a little bit about how the webcomic got started.
So I have been dabbling in the webcomic space since I was a teenager. What I love about webcomics is it's so accessible, you know, literally anyone can do one. All you need is a website.
No, and that's not true. I could not.
Oh, really? Well,
some expectation okay. Being able to draw something, I think.
I'm sorry. Sometimes I literally forget that other people cannot draw. I'm sorry. You know, like any artist, I suppose, can make a webcomic. And, you know, as a result, like I could experiment with that from a very young age. I kind of, you know, dabbled in webcomics as a teenager here and there, but, you know, didn't want to settle on a story. It's a really common thing to be like, oh, I'm going to start a webcomic. And then you like restart the first chapter like 20 times and you never actually finish the story. Mm-hmm. So I'd done that many, many times. I put it away as I was like very seriously pursuing animation. And then when it came to, you know, that moment, I was like, oh, I really want to tell my own story, but I don't know how. Well, one thing I knew that I could do was make a webcomic, you know? And so it was just this very natural thing. I did get specifically advice to be like, hey, don't do like a big epic comic straight out the bat. You're like, please start with something small, simple. So I actually did like, I did a Kickstarter for just like a short prequel comic called Bleeding Heart beforehand. And with that, that was pretty successful. We met our stretch goals. And I then got to learn the process of, you know, having a comic, but then like, you know, really taking it to a pretty professional level, taking it to print, making sure everything really looked nice and the presentation was nice. And it was cool to see, you know, the response from that. And I was able to kind of take that momentum and start, you know, the comic with that, you know, that small readership that has, you know, grown over the years. But that first little comic was very much the spark. And that was a really fun little project to, you know, begin the journey on.
Yeah. So this is the thing that always I'm always so curious about. And it seems somewhat unique to webcomic artists, although maybe not. I'd have to give some more thought to that. But this idea that you're creating and probably working on a schedule, maybe you release, you know, a new chapter every week or once a month or however frequently it is. Mm-hmm. But of course, the idea is that it's all going to build into one complete story by the end.
Yeah.
How much do you plan out in advance?
Yeah, so I had the entire story planned out pretty heavily in advance. I think I planned out the original outline in like 2014, I want to say. So it's been around for a long time. And then I'm still writing like the final draft of the script. I'm about a chapter ahead of where I am in the art. I think the big difference between the art and the writing is that the art, because there is just such a massive amount of it, it does have to be on a really, really strict schedule. But, you know, with writing, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, it kind of doesn't like to conform to schedules all the time. And so I like to be a little bit more loosey-goosey with that timeline so that in case, you know, I need to do a really heavy rewrite or like this thing is just not working or just I'm really struggling with this or that, I have a little bit more wiggle room in that space. Mm-hmm. I also have wiggle room where like, yes, the outline was done very early, but it's kind of bonkers to have to lock yourself into how you saw the world when, you know, you were, in my case, 25, you know, about 10 years ago now. And so even though the outline has stayed pretty much the same, like the overall direction, I do have space, you know, within scenes and within individual character arcs to update and play around within reason. I feel like I definitely learned that from working in television animation, you know, where you're still writing as you go, but you're also a little bit locked in to the stuff you've done before. You cannot completely retcon everything unless you're like Zero Heroes season two and like you're just like, that just didn't happen.
Which I imagine, are there times when you wish you could do that? Like, not just that was all a dream starting over.
Yeah, thankfully, just with like small things in the webcom, definitely in TV animation, absolutely. But for the comic, I've been like pretty consistent. I think because it is one story as opposed to, again, television animation where you're doing like half hour stories over and over and over. I think there's a lot more to regret in a way. Mm-hmm. Because this is a single story, there's less of that. There's a couple moments where I'm like, oh, that got dropped. You know, like, oh, like that panel was trying to allude to something that did not happen, you know? but hopefully it doesn't interrupt the reading experience too much.
Yeah. So when you're creating a chapter, let's say, is that what we call it? You know, a chapter?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have like a set of guidelines or rules for things that kind of have to happen every chapter? Because it would be different when you just produce a graphic novel whole and people have the whole story all at once. I would think that there are some different ways of thinking about story if they're just getting it in little chunks week after week.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall I've tended to think of it as more of like the entire story, because otherwise what they're really getting like a page a week. You cannot give like a satisfying story piece at one page at a time. Mm-hmm. So just realistically, I couldn't think in those terms, because I feel like, you know, if I were like a daily webcomic with like, you know, a gag at the end of each page, that's a very different format than what I'm doing.
Sure. Yeah.
The downside of which is that when you're collecting it into books, I do worry for people who are picking it up the first time. And I'm like, gosh, I hope this is enough story for y'all. It's going to make sense eventually. But like, it's a little bit of a trade-off, you know? And I think I've been fortunate that I kind of happened to land on spaces where it's like, there's like a decent cliffhanger at the end of both volumes one and two. So I hope that's enough to, you know, get people excited for the next one and to tie them over. But definitely I was not thinking of each individual volume as its own complete story. It's very much part of a larger story.
Right. It is a series. Mm-hmm. So transitioning from webcomic to now a published graphic novel, did you make any changes?
This may very well have been my agent, getting this through, where I think she advocated for me really, really nicely. In that, you know, she's represented a lot of people who work in animation, understand that like, yo, this is not, writing is not our full-time job. Our full-time job is a lot of work. And that, especially with a webcomic, you've already kind of made it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that I was, you know, against getting edits. I am very, very open to feedback, but it's purely just like from a practical standpoint, like if I were to get a you know, an edit letter being like, you know, this scene could use rewrites here, here, and here, I'd be like, I completely agree with you. It's not happening, you know? And it's just the pure man hours that goes into every single page. We can make little changes. And like, actually, what was really nice is that my publisher is Penguin, who is, of course, you know, they're relatively new to the graphic novel space. And I think they tend to approach editing from a more a text point of view, understandably. So the majority of the edits were regarding the dialogue. That's no problem. For me, the harder part is going to be the art, you know, just because that just takes so much longer. So not a huge amount was changed between the webcomic and the comic. Is just the little changes here and there, little updates, a little bit of polishing, but you're definitely getting like the full experience picking up the book. There's not a lot you're missing out on, honestly.
Yeah.
Except all the rest of the story, of course.
You have to wait a little bit longer if you're going to read the physical volumes.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the opening chapter, we meet 8 billion characters, approximately. Mm. There's like a huge cast in this story.
Yeah.
How did you go about creating them? And I mean, I assume that was a decision that must have been made, like, what you say, 8 years ago when you first started it. Have you had regrets since then? Why did I have so many characters?
I mean, I regret every single panel that has more than one character on it, so yes. But, you know, I think the idea to have this society of mad scientists, this big, colorful, lively secondary cast, I think that came actually from one, like, a role play that I used to do in high school with a friend, where it kind of built out of like, oh, we like these different, you know, classic mad scientist characters. What if there were this like place where they all came to live? I was actually also a little bit inspired by my college. I went to the school called CalArts, which is this kind of historically well-known school for animation specifically. Of course, there are other disciplines as well. The way that our department was arranged was that the animation department had like a central, a ground floor level with all the little classrooms in it. And then arranged in several tiers above it were all these little workplace cubicles where everyone had a little tiny place where all their art was, and they could make their own little projects and whatnot. And it was just this very, very lively kind of little beehive of creativity. And I think that kind of inspired, you know, having this, the Society for Arcane Sciences, where all these mad scientists, all these, you know, essentially these creatives coming together and having that creative energy of working together. So that's something that was very important to the story from the beginning. But I do try to balance that out. But like, this is definitely Dr. Jekyll's story. So I try and focus that, like, yes, it does have a big cast, but it's not really an ensemble story. It is very much one character's story with these colorful secondary characters, kind of adding a little bit of liveliness, in the margins. One thing that has been nice though about building out, you know, this society for mad scientists is that it's one of those things in fandom that encourages fans to kind of dream themselves into the story, you know? Mm. It's like, you know, with Hogwarts houses, you know, all the bad stuff about J.K. Rowling notwithstanding, where you can be like, oh, well, I'm a Gryffindor, I'm a Ravenclaw. You know, in this story, you can be like, oh, well, here's the particular kind of mad scientist that I would be, here's my costume, here is what my discipline would be. And there was a period where, like, I had to actually kind of go into the comments because people were role-playing their characters in the comments and like massively inflating the comment count. So I couldn't see who was actually commenting on it because people would just be role-playing. I had to be like, guys, this is great. Please take this elsewhere. I cannot see people talking about the actual page. And there were actually still like role-play forums for the comic, which is really cool.
That is really cool. And I bet you get amazing cosplay.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, what's funny. I actually haven't gotten like original character cosplays. Mostly I'm getting Jekyll and Hyde, which I sure love. It's been, those are really, really cool though. Yeah. Getting cosplayers.
So as you say, it's not an ensemble story. You know, they're really just kind of on the margins, all this big cast of characters, but do you have a way of like keeping track of them? Because even though they're not the focus of the story, they each have very clear personalities, and obviously they're all off doing their own experiments and things. Like, do you have a way of keeping track of what each one has going on?
Yeah, I think kind of to more or less extent with each character. Like there's one character, the junior neo-alchemist character, Virginia Ito, who gets a little bit of a highlight in chapter 2. I've definitely planned her out a bit more, in no small part because she is Japanese. I'm half Japanese and I'm very interested in that history. And so I've definitely planned out her a little bit more because of that. But I think for the most part, I do try to have like a very kind of a simple, like elevator pitch version of each character. Because again, because there's such a large cast, they often don't get like a ton of time to each single one, but I try and give them at least like, you know, like one clear personality trait and one clear, like visual quirk, so that you can recognize them and track them throughout the story. Mm. And I think that's something that I've learned from like, you know, doing like smaller, you know, larger casts for screenplays as well. Where like, you know, you're not going to understand the full implication of the backstory, but to give readers enough that they can kind of, you know, continue to imagine into that space.
Mm-hmm. And it gives a layer of depth to the world as a whole, too. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't feel like they're just placeholders. You feel like each one has a story. We're just not following that story right now.
Yeah. And I do want to, you know, kind of drop little hints that these are people who come from all different walks of life. In a way, like, it's a little bit similar to, like, you know, a queer community as well, where people are coming in with all these different, you know, backgrounds, all their different baggage, all these different, you know, competing, you know, needs and desires and vulnerabilities. But they've all kind of come together under this mantle to work towards something together, because at the end of the day, they're all outsiders.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your process. Like, if you're starting on a new page, let's say, or a new chapter, do you write a script? Do you storyboard it? Do you write dialogue first and then start drawing? Like, how does it come together?
Yes, I'm like a really, really heavy outliner, to the point that I actually probably want to, like, force myself to draw back a little bit. I get, like, you know, as everyone does, I have a big fear of, like, the blank page, right? I particularly get really, really tripped up on, like, elegant word choice kinds of things. Like, I'm the sort of person where I will get so intimidated whenever there's, like I was reading, like, that Brandon Sanderson kind of hit piece in Wired recently, and, like, they do a thing where they're like, oh, well, this is proof that this person is a bad writer, and they pull out one sentence. And I'm like, oh God, what's going to be that one sentence for me? We're both going to read it and be like, oh, based on that one sentence, this person is garbage, you know? So, like, yeah. I can get so hung up on, like, you know, that kind of word choice level stuff. And so I'm the person who will do, like, the Comic Sans technique. Do you know that one?
No.
So the premise is that, you know, writing is scary. Comic Sans is inherently silly looking. So if you go into your word program or whatever, and you change the font to Comic Sans, your brain will kind of be like, oh, this is not serious. And it'll take some of the pressure off, yeah. Right? So I'll do that. And I also, like, I will quote unquote outline, but I'll just get, my outlines will just get progressively and progressively more intense until functionally they are scripts. But I'm like, I'm not scripting yet. The pressure is still not on. So I'm all about tricking my brain into not realizing what it's doing.
I am also a big fan of tricking my brain. I have a number of techniques too that I'm like, it's not work. We're just playing around still.
Yeah. Cause I can absolutely get so paralyzed when it comes to work. Like, when I'm having to finalize some design pages right now, and, like, paragraph by paragraph, it is just, everything is a torture. So
yeah.
The more that I can keep myself in that exploratory phase and tell myself that it's not a big deal. Usually that's when much better ideas come out, cause they're not tortured and they're not, you know, that you can't feel the pain in the writing, and it allows you to just be more free.
Yeah, and that's fun too. I mean, if we're just playing around, then you can enjoy the process rather than having all of this pressure and the internal criticism and, mm-hmm. you know, all the things that can drag us down creatively. Mm-hmm. If you can kind of try to keep in mind that, you know, I'm just messing around with really cool characters and seeing what happens, then it just brings a lot more, you know, joy to the process, which is, you know, kind of our shtick here on The Happy Writer.
Yeah. And I feel like, in a way, like, I think I tend to be happiest in a creative space. Sometimes when I'm absorbing, like, other stories and, like, being like, oh, how am I reacting to this? What do I have a desire to write based off what I'm viewing? I mean, that's one of the aspects also that kind of inspired this book, because I was obsessed with Jekyll and Hyde for so long. It is a story that's been adapted enormously over the years. There's over 100 adaptations of this story. And every time I would watch a new version, I'd be like, this is cool, but now I want to do this. You're like, oh, this is interesting, but I want to take it in this direction. And I feel like keeping in that outline space keeps it in that more playful, you know, just like, just engaging with a story, having a reaction. And then, you know, I feel like, in a way, like, your readers are going to be like that too. And I definitely see that on a day-to-day basis with the page updates. People will be, you know, they'll speculate about this or that, be like, oh, wouldn't it be this scenario be fun or that scenario be fun? Obviously, I can't let that affect the story itself, because otherwise I'd be full on Game of Thrones rewriting the story based off the Reddit, which is not in a good space to be. But seeing that creativity is really helpful, and seeing that, like, oh, like, this level of ideation and, you know, playing around and coming up with unexpected ideas can be really difficult to access when I think you're in the thick of it. So it's really nice to do anything that I can to preserve that space and protect it.
Yeah, no, 100%. I couldn't agree more. I did want to go back and touch on one thing you mentioned, how, you know, there are these reviews that will come out where they like pick out one sentence and like, look, they're a terrible writer. Because I had a review in for one of my books in the New York Times, I think this was years ago. And it was one of those, like, it was not a great review. And they had, you know, four or five examples of sentences out of the book that they were like, these are just terrible. And like, for the record, I don't think I'm a perfect writer. I do think that there are probably sentences that today I'd be like, ugh, cringe. But reading their review, the ones that they had picked out, I was like, I actually think these are okay. I don't see the problem. So for me, it was like just one of those, yeah, it's all subjective.
Yeah. And like, again, I went down a super deep rabbit hole with this Brandon Sanderson interview of like people then critiquing the interview. One of the funny things about that was, you know, people saying like, hey, like sentence by sentence and word choice is not really how most viewers, oh my gosh, I'm sorry, I'm thinking animation, how most readers are absorbing books. They're absorbing it for the story. And in that Wired piece, he was like, ugh, you know, Brandon Sanderson, he can't write. All he cares about are story, characters, and the ending. And I was saying, really? Oh yeah, who cares about endings? You know, we all know endings do not matter in books. It's all
what
about
an amateur.
I know. And like, clearly, and also just like, clearly you can feel him, like the frustration of like, well, but what real auteurs do not read him, only people read his books, you know. And I found that so funny. Like, I'm never going to be like a super intense literary writer. So I probably have some, you know, inferiority complex about that. But just like, I don't know, man, like I just don't think I can think that way. And I feel like when you're writing, there's so many, many, many things that you can be focusing on. And I think if you try to focus on all of them, you'll just end up doing all of them in a kind of mediocre way. Mm. You know, like the animation equivalent is like, just today we're getting notes back from our network criticizing the back legs of a walk cycle on a dog who is not the focus of a shot, to the point that we had to go back and forth between two frames and stare at them for about a minute or so and be like, oh yeah, that's a little off. But I'm like, one, this is a children's cartoon. Kids aren't going to pick it up. Two, I like, if you have to have like 20 years of experience in the animation industry to pick out a flaw, I don't think that's where your focus should be, you know?
Yeah.
And where I get frustrated.
Perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. And where I get frustrated is kind of like, yo, these things are never going to be perfect. When you're spending your time at this level of detail and this level of minutia, there are things that you're not paying attention to. You know, it's a choice. You know, it's always a choice between, you know, what you're going to fix and what you're going to live with. And, you know, if you try and be a perfectionist, I think things are going to slip through the cracks.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. I think it's important to try to keep perspective on what exactly is it that we are trying to accomplish here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And same with novel writing. Yeah. Trying to think, am I telling a story that is exciting, that is romantic, that is, you know, will keep readers engaged, or is getting whatever message I'm trying to tell across? Like, those are the things that we should be kind of coming back to again and again. Not necessarily, is this a perfectly crafted sentence? Is this the best possible word I could use here? You know, which of course, it's never a bad thing to try to improve your skills and your craft and, you know, check a thesaurus, sure. But yeah, you can lose sight of what is it you're actually trying to do here.
Yeah. And like, of course there's obviously like a huge merit to that more literary type of writing. It's a very different thing. And I think it's great. There's nothing wrong with it. But I don't, like, I think what's hard for me especially is, you know, even if you kind of keep your values right and are like, no, this is what I care about, and these are the things that I'm choosing to let go, it's so hard when you get that review, especially if it's from a very prestigious place, I imagine, and to lose focus on that and to like ruminate on it. I'm like, I have not been looking at the reviews for the book so far.
No, reviews are terrible. Yeah. Don't look.
I've been told that.
It helps nobody.
Yeah. But like, it's so hard not to. And like, I can't deny that, like, you know, one of the things I would fantasize about is that, like, you know, there's a couple reviewers who are like, oh, I really wish, you know, they would talk about my book the way they talk about other people's books. It's almost like a weird kind of like reviewer jealousy in a way. But, you know, I like, again, objectively, I know that like that's not what's actually going to make me happy. And that's not the thing. But it's so hard not to get wrapped up with that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is difficult. It gets easier. I feel, at least for me, it's gotten easier to, over the years to not read reviews, to, you know, not pay attention, and just to know that it is subjective and you can't please everyone. There's gonna be people that don't like your work for whatever reason. And for me, I just always try to stay focused on hoping that the book finds the people that are going to connect with it.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here like trying to like drink your words into my soul and just like absorb them.
That's my advice, like, right there.
Like, I know, like, on a soul level that it's true, you know, like I've heard it so many times, but I just have to like internalize it more. And I do think it is about finding the audience, you know, like, you know, Mad Scientist isn't going to be like a crazy mainstream, you know, like mega blockbuster, but I do feel like there's a specific niche. And gosh, I just really hope it does find that niche.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously you already have readers. You've already found a lot of that. And I think that this is just going to push it to a new level, open it up to people who aren't there in the webcomic sphere. No, you're going to be just fine.
Gosh, I hope so. I really hope so.
All right. Are you ready for our bonus round?
Yes.
What book makes you happy?
Oh my goodness. Oh my God. Actually, could I pause and think about this for a second? I'm so sorry.
Sure. No, this is, I know it's kind of a tough one to like pull out of thin air.
Oh my gosh. I feel like I should have had, you said like the things that make you happy. I should have had this like on the down low already. Okay. This is so not within my genre and like still not the answer I should be giving, but like, I love the Area X trilogy, like the Annihilation books, if you're familiar.
I am not.
Oh, okay. They made a movie out of them a couple of years ago. It's kind of like this like surreal environmentalist speculative horror kind of. And, you know, the movie did quite well. The movie takes a little bit more of like, puts a little bit more action into it. The books are really just vibing and dark and spooky, but also just like very psychological and internal. I weirdly feel like it's a book for if you were like a weird loner kid who didn't have many friends. And so you just kind of like stared at nature all the time. It's a very good book for like that kind of just like contemplative vibing with the world. And it's spooky, but it's also just like comforting in a weird way. So I have that, you know, just on my little coffee table at all times. And it's one of my favorite books.
What are you working on next?
Oh my gosh. I'm possibly planning on taking the Glass Scientist out for like film and TV shopping, which I do not have the energy for, but I may be doing anyway. In terms of like a whole next project, I would like to do something that really kind of explores mixed race identity a lot more. It's kind of allegorical in the Glass Scientist. But I want it to be really front and center. I also want it to be something about monsters because I can't get entirely away from that allegory piece. But I just want to really attack a more modern take on mixed identity very directly.
Lastly, where can people find you?
You can find me on all social media, Instagram, Twitter, etc. at Arethusa. That is spelled Arythusa. You can find The Glass Scientist anywhere books are sold. But if you want signed copies or if you want to continue reading the webcomic, you can find that at The Glass Scientists, that is plural, scientists.com.
Awesome. Sage, thank you so much for joining me.
Awesome. This is so much fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
Readers, definitely check out The Glass Scientist. Volume 1 is out now, and as you heard, you can then hop right on over to the webcomic and keep on reading. Of course, we always encourage you to support your local indie bookstore. If you don't have a local indie, you can check out our affiliate store at bookshop.org/shop/Marissa Meyer. Next week, I will be talking with Terry J. Benton Walker about his new apocalyptic middle grade, Alex Wise versus The End of the World. If you're enjoying these conversations, please subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Marissa Meyer Author and at Happy Writer Podcast. Until next time, stay inspired, keep writing, and whatever life throws at you today, I hope that now you're feeling a little bit happier.